This episode is brought to you by Progressive, where drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average. Plus, auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Quote now at progressive.com to see if you could save. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates, national average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
So why do you want to learn a new language?
I'll tell you why. Because ¿dónde está el baño? Can be a very important question at times. You know, Rosetta Stone is the most trusted language learning program, available on desktop or as an app. Fast track your language acquisition with immersive lessons designed to teach you to pick up languages in a natural way. I love the fact that I can go from my laptop to my phone to pretty much anywhere and learn the language of my choice. Not to mention, I'm bringing my communication skills to new heights. Don't put off learning that language. There's no better time than right now to get started. For a limited time, StarTalk Radio listeners can get Rosetta Stone's lifetime membership for 50% off. Visit rosettastone.com/StarTalk. That's 50% off unlimited access to 25 language courses for the rest of your life. Redeem your 50% off at rosettastone.com/StarTalk today.
From the American Museum of Natural History in New York City and beaming out across all of space and time, this is Star Talk, where science and pop culture collide. This is Star Talk. I'm your host, Neil deGrasse Tyson, your personal astrophysicist. And today we are talking about sci-fi in literature and in movies. Ooh. I got with me my co-host, Chuck Nice. Chuck.
Hey, Neil.
So, Chuck, we have between us.
Yes.
Jason Ellis, who's an assistant professor of English at New York City College of Technology, City Tech, we call it.
Wow.
And you teach a course on science fiction.
That's right.
They didn't do that when I was in school.
There were no courses on science
fiction. We were learning all these folks, they were all dead, yeah. And talking about a time, right. in a way it with no way understood.
Yeah, they were like, no, it's about real science. Okay, you don't even know real science. You have to know that before you can. Do you have to know real science before you write science fiction?
We're getting there, Chuck. Oh, so we had a whole show, Chuck. We let it happen organically, Chuck.
Okay.
So... So we're talking about this relationship, and we're featuring my interview with Gail Ann Hurd.
Ooh.
Gail Ann Hurd, I'm a credit watcher at the end of shows.
Okay.
I don't know if you are. It's hard.
You're
on TV.
You're one of those people.
It's on TV, like it's hard because they roll the
credit. In the movies.
I'm there. I'm the last one out, and they're asking me, get the hell out. Okay.
Let me tell you something. People who make films love you. Because that is the ultimate sign of respect.
And you, as
is
you know,
to sit and read the credits at the end of a film,
right on down to who supplied the food,
right?
The food truck,
exactly. Yeah, craft services by Reggie.
Reggie and Son,
right? Right.
And so you teach us a course on science fiction, and as I understand this, you curate their science fiction library.
That's right. We got a donation of over 600 linear feet of materials, including 4,000.
You're measuring
magazines.
Books by feet.
Right. If you think of like a standard shelf is 3 feet wide, 600 feet long, that's a lot of books.
That's a lot of books, dude. Lot of books. And so you're the man for that stash.
I help coordinate it with the library, mm-hmm. But it's a really tremendous resource that we have now.
And a lot of science fiction first appears in magazines, if I remember correctly. Is that correct?
That's right. More so in the past than today, but certainly there's a very vibrant publishing industry in science fiction magazines now. Like Astounding Science Fiction's having their 90th anniversary this year.
Astounding Science Fiction, 90th anniversary.
Wow.
Wow. Yeah. So Gail Ann Hurd is a producer, and I think her first day on the block was The Terminator.
Nice.
Good movie to start out on.
Yes.
Start your career.
Right.
What a baptism that is. Did the whole trilogy. She's got Armageddon under her belt.
Okay.
But don't get me started. That movie violates more laws of physics per minute than any other movie that has ever been made.
Love.
Just FYI.
Love it.
She did Dante's Peak. So these are films that are different branches of science. Dante's Peak, of course, is a volcano.
Right.
Also did, of course, The Walking Dead for television.
Wow.
So science fiction, science fantasy. And so when did you first get into science fiction? Because you're an academic professional at it, so...
Right. I guess I've had a lot
of... A lot of academics, it's something from childhood, right?
It is. It is for me, too. My first, strong memory I remember is when I was 3 years old, watching...
Three?
3 years old.
Nice.
I'm in front of...
Back when I was three.
It's like probably the only thing I remember from back then, but it was like in burned on my brain. Of seeing the Millennium Falcon deftly maneuvering between the asteroids in a trailer for The Empire Strikes Back when it first came out.
Right.
And it was playing the drive-in, and my folks saying, no, we're not going to the drive-in to see that. And so it was like this tension of the desire to see this fantastic spectacle on the screen and being told I couldn't.
So then on, so you got imprinted.
Yes, and it's something that stuck with me throughout the years.
Since then, all right.
Did you ever get to see Star Wars?
I did get to see Star Wars. I've seen it hundreds, thousands of times probably.
So, which medium were you most enchanted by? The film, TV, or?
It was primarily film originally, and then television became a part of it later on. And I didn't get into reading science fiction until I was a teenager.
Until you learned how to read.
Well, I had to learn how to read first. But
yeah, it happened a little after three.
Right.
Just a few months.
Right. But it was strange for me to get into reading science fiction because I originally, you really enjoyed reading science popularizations, Einstein's Relativity, Stephen Hawking's A Brief History of Time, Mirror Matter, other books like that, Carl Sagan, his works. And it was one of my friends, Marty Magden, Boy Scouts.
So popular nonfiction science,
right,
what you're talking about.
Right,
yeah.
Right. Who worked at the local Barnes & Noble. I was having him order new books once the library was out of stuff that I could read. And he said, Jason, you ought to try out science fiction. And so he introduced me to Asimov and Bradbury and Clark and got me into reading it.
That's the Trinity.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Three of the early grandmasters,
Okay, very cool, dude. So, of course, I had to know how Gail Ann Hurd got interested in this. And so, let's check it out. So, I'm looking at this filmography, and it has very strong overlap with the geekosphere.
I am. I'm a geek. I'm a nerd. Before there were words to describe it.
Were you a girl nerd?
My God, yes. Are you kidding?
Oh, my gosh. So, how early did this manifest?
I started reading comic books when I was six.
Okay.
And, this is how geeky I am, all right?
But I don't think girls did back then.
No,
I looked at the ads and the back was all for guys.
No.
All the ads were for...
No, but I love them all, and I admit I was a Marvel girl.
Okay.
Okay. Guilty as charged.
Mm-hmm.
And then I graduated into science fiction novels. Both YA, which...
Young adult,
YA didn't exist back then.
It wasn't its own category, really.
No. It was still children's.
Uh-huh.
Children's books. And I became so obsessed with it that I actually advised the local library, this is Palm Springs, California, and suggested what books they should acquire in science fiction, fantasy.
You were out ahead of the librarians.
And then I started writing book reviews, and predominantly about science fiction, fantasy.
People who read a lot disappoint me if they do not take that wisdom that they've acquired and somehow share it with others. Because you're keeping it all locked up into yourself. And the fact that you're writing reviews, you've satisfied my...
Thank you. Thank you.
You're okay by me.
Thank
on
you.
This. That you've obtained some kind of insight into the human condition, into storytelling. And then other people get to know about it. So
I was not only passionate, but I was proselytizing for the genre.
So Jason... Other than sheer entertainment, is there some other value you can ascribe to reading science fiction? And I ask that because if you read novels, people can be entertained by novels, but at the end of the day, you also gain a little extra insight into the human condition and human emotion and love and hate and war and peace. So there's an extra, and maybe if it's embedded in a history, you learn a little bit about the history of the world. So in sci-fi, what else do you get out of it?
I guess one of the things that I like about science fiction is that it combines the STEM fields with the humanities.
Science, technology, engineering, math.
Yeah. Right, exactly. And so instead of just having a story about science and technology, it looks at how science and technology affects individuals and society. And it's through those means that we get to ethical questions, philosophical questions.
Very good.
Absolutely, yeah. I think that's one of the things that drew me to science fiction as a kid was my first encounter, I would say, wasn't reading. It was Star Trek. Uh-huh. And what I really liked was not the spaceship and not the fact that there were aliens, but the fact that all of mankind worked together. Mm. And I thought that was the coolest thing in the world, that all these different people were on this ship and they never ever talked about their differences. Mm-hmm. Not once.
Interesting.
They never, right, ever acknowledged that anybody would. And then they would meet these, like, creepy, crazy-looking aliens, and they would never say, like, what's up with your face? You know, they would just say, like,
you're some ugly aliens.
Right, exactly.
That never happened.
Right.
They were objectively ugly.
They made them objectively ugly. Like, yeah. It's so funny.
But it never became a topic.
And it was never anything that, like, no one's appearance ever became an issue.
So, Jason, mm-hmm, let me ask then. Is science, hold aside the reader, mm-hmm, is science fiction a way for the writer to offer social commentary?
Oh, certainly. And I think that Gene Roddenberry's Star Trek is an excellent example of this, where not only are you showing how people work together, you have equality amongst the sexes inside the crew. And also you can think about how the first kiss between a white person and an African-American on television was in Star Trek. And it was largely not just, you know, on the part of Gene Roddenberry wanting that moment to happen,
right,
but also the part of William Shatner and Nichelle Nichols, you're wanting it to happen, because they would flub the takes when they were told not to actually kiss for the cameras, because the producers and the studio was like, we don't want to see that on TV. But Shatner and Nichols, they kept messing up those takes, but always nailed the ones where they were actually kissing, because they knew how important that was for people to see that on television.
And of course, Bill Shatner really liked kissing Lieutenant Uhura.
Well, so the weird thing is, of course, when they did kiss, they got mail from, you know, some southern states, mm-hmm, objecting to this on television. But I don't think they ever got mail when Shatner was kissing
the green,
green aliens. Green aliens, not even human, okay?
That's, I can't, okay, believe you're kissing an alien. Dude, that's amazing.
Yeah, yeah. So apparently, so there's social commentary, but not all authors think about that kind of effect, I presume. Mm-hmm. Is that correct?
I would say so, but even if someone isn't intentionally providing some social commentary, science fiction is extrapolating from the here and now. Whether it's something that's in the far future or an alien world, or even extrapolating to the past, like with steampunk, it's everything based around the authors or the directors, filmmakers, attitudes, beliefs, knowledge, etc.
So if science fiction is a conduit to the future, mm-hmm, and it's not only movies, of course, but comic books, mm-hmm, and other media. Uh-huh. And so I asked Gail and Heard about whether any of this background that she enjoyed with science fiction influenced her choice of movie that she elected to produce. Let's check it out. At the risk of stating the obvious, your geek roots in comics, comic book stories, science fiction, they manifest in this filmography.
Yes.
Strongly. So how are you doing?
What is
going on here?
I make what I'd like to see. And my newest show is Falling Water for USA Network. Which is...
Oh, I have yet to see that, but everybody's telling me to see it.
It is.
Everybody.
Mean, fantastic.
Everybody.
So why weren't you listening to them?
Okay. Tonight, I'll dig up some episode.
You.
Tonight.
Thank you. You
okay, because I felt bad. I got to know what the pulse is out there. Otherwise,
Because it is... I mean, if you liked Inception, that was a great amuse-bouche,
mm-hmm,
for Falling Water. Because
Inception, these are the nested dreams of reality.
And we're following in Following Water, we're following three different characters who are all seeking something, something that's missing from their lives.
And there's a shared dream among them or something?
It turns out that one of the conceits of the show is that we're all dreaming separate tiles of a large mosaic. And certain powerful dreamers can leave their dream and enter yours, or mine, or anyone's, and just think of the power that that will have, and how valuable they will become to people who want more control than they already have over the world.
So, Jason, can you assess the causes and effects of the chicken-egg technology shown or imagined in science fiction? Does it become real? Is something that we do in science that then gets adopted, but they take it another step? What is that relationship?
I think it's a very complex relationship, one where both feed into each other. It's like a feedback loop that works in both directions. Mm-hmm. So as science and technology create new innovations, those things get incorporated into the science fiction that we enjoy and the comic books that we enjoy. But at the same time, people come up with new ideas, try to stretch the boundaries of possibility, such as Jerry Pournelle I forget the other author's name, wrote a book in the 1970s, The Mote in God's Eye, and they imagined—
The Mote in God's Eye,
mm-hmm. in which they imagined personal computers, pocket computers that you would carry around. And 30, 40 years later, then we had that reality.
Right. You know, it's funny because Jeff Bezos just did an interview.
The head of Amazon.
Head of Amazon did an interview where he talked about Alexa being inspired by the way people talk to computers in the sci-fi movies and TV shows that he saw when he was a kid. Mm-hmm. And I thought about it, I was like, that's so funny. Like, in all sci-fi, people talk to the computer, they go, computer, working, you know? It's like, it's so, and now we do that.
And it's almost always a female voice.
And it's almost always a female voice, you know? But even 2001 Space Flight, he's talking to the computer.
Oh, how?
How? You know, and I'm sorry, Dave. Like, you know, I can't do that, right? Mm-hmm. So it's weird that we now actually
do that.
And we take it for granted that we say, you know, okay, Google, or hey, Alexa, or Siri, and we take it for granted. It's so weird.
But I would say that it's not just that one-way street of science fiction imagining this new possibility and it comes reality, but also that the things that are discovered, the new things that are found in science and technological innovation also feed their way back into science fiction. Because the thing is, like, with really the way like the iPad works, or really the way that Alexa works, the way that we understand it now, wasn't envisioned in science fiction. We can trace it back and see where there might be a little bit of inspiration, but it wasn't the thing itself.
Okay, right. So this is the complex elements. It's more a tapestry of information coming together.
That's right.
As opposed to a linear track that you can establish.
Right. There's a really good example of this, if I can share it, with H.G. Wells. He wrote The Land Ironclads, a story about the first modern battle tank. And it was some years later, Major General Swinton invented the tank for the British military with the advent, or it led into the advent of World War I. Later, Wells sued Swinton, claiming ownership of that invention of the tank.
Then Swinton showed up at his house
with
blew it away.
an actual tank. You got a tank. You just wrote about it. Who's, I made the thing.
Who's suing who now?
Luckily, it didn't have to go that far, but Wells did lose that court case. And I think rightly so, because even though he was able to show that Swinton had read the Strand magazine that the story appeared in, science fiction is something that I think can inspire, give people ideas. It can provide motivation for new research, but it isn't necessarily like the actual patent application.
Right.
We're going to take a break. When we come back, more of my interview with Gail Ann Hurd, the producer of really cool sci-fi movies and TV shows, when Star Talk returns.
This is Star Talk. Small business owners are always passionate about their work, and they have a lot on the line. Let Verizon help champion your small business dream. Whether you own a small business or scaling one or starting one from scratch, you need to get ready for Verizon Small Business Days. From April 22nd through April 28th, you can partner with Verizon business experts for small business support. During Verizon Small Business Days, you can receive a free tech check with a one-on-one meeting with a Verizon business expert. Plus, Verizon business experts will provide you with personalized advice and solutions that are tailored to your specific small business needs. Take advantage of special offers and deals during Verizon Small Business Days and get more for your business. Verizon has your back because they know small businesses can make a big difference. Don't miss out. Book an appointment today. Just call 1-800-483-4428 or go to verizon.com/smallbusiness.
This podcast is supported by FedEx. Dear small and medium businesses, no one wants happy customers more than you do. So you need a business partner just like you, like FedEx, who understands your passion for serving your customers because they have the same commitment towards you. That's why FedEx offers you picture proof of delivery, packageless and paperless returns, as well as weekend home delivery to 98% of the US on Saturday and 50% on Sunday. See the FedEx service guide for delivery information. What's more, FedEx Ground is faster to more locations than UPS Ground. Trust FedEx for timely deliveries. See what FedEx can do for your business. Absolutely, positively, FedEx.
Whether you're a family vacation traveler, business tripper, or long weekend adventurer, Choice Hotels has a stay for any you. And that's good, because there are a lot of me's. Choice Hotels has over 7,400 locations and 22 brands, including Comfort Hotels, Radisson Hotels, and Cambria Hotels. Get the best value for your money when you book with Choice Hotels. Cambria Hotels feature locally inspired hotel bars with specialty cocktails and downtown locations in the center of it all. Hey, that's me. Radisson Hotels have flexible workspaces to get the most of your business travel and on-site restaurants. That's me, too. And at Comfort Hotels, you'll enjoy free hot breakfast with fresh waffles, great pools for the entire family, and spacious rooms. Hey, that's me, too. I guess I'm just going to have to stay at all of them. Choice Hotels has a stay for any you. Book direct at choicehotels.com, where travel comes true.
We're back. Star Talk. This episode all about science fiction as it's represented in film, in books, in comics, in television. Featuring my interview with Gail Ann Hurd, who's a prodigious producer of just this kind of product. And
say that five times fast.
Prodigious
producer of this kind of product.
Let's pick up where I just asked her about how much does she think about the accuracy of science in sci-fi films. Let's check it out.
I'm looking at the, the Terminator, Aliens, Alien Nation, The Abyss. That was all underwater there. And this just goes on and on and on. Armageddon. So I got to tell you my relationship with Armageddon.
Okay.
So let me say of Armageddon that I found the movie thoroughly entertaining. Just the writing, the timing, that mixture of actors, the wit, the emotion. It was just fun. Okay, that's my first of all comments. That being said, in my community, Armageddon is one of the films we reference in science class for how many laws of physics are violated.
Well, what's really funny is the last thing I was hearing about was if an asteroid was coming, that people have decided that some of the science in Armageddon, which we know was faux science, was actually, like, not the worst. We were not the worst.
The worst, okay.
I probably have another one in there. And by the way, we could spend an entire hour on Dante's Peak. I mean, the volcanologists, because this is the thing. So we were like, we have a Cascades volcano. They don't have lava. It's pyroclastic flows, et cetera.
Pyroclastic flows.
So the studio, which we'll go and mention, said, no, volcanoes have lava. It's like, there are different kinds of volcanoes.
They didn't care.
We had a volcanologist named Jack Lockwood who was fantastic. And I kept saying, you know, I kept sending him scripts saying, I'm sorry, I can't get this changed. So we tried to get other things right in terms of the earthquakes and the pyroclastic flow that we did have.
Let's bring in a geologist. I've got Janine Krippner on Skype. Janine, welcome to Star Talk.
Thank you very much.
So you're a volcanologist. Mm. So this with yeah. this is, you know, Spock. He's a volcanologist.
Live long and prosper, Janine.
Volcanologist with the Smithsonian Global Volcanism Program. That's actually a thing. And also a science communicator and blogger for In the Company of Volcanoes. So that's a thing. And you haven't melted yet or anything. You're one of these people who walks up to volcanoes and studies them.
Yes, I am. But I study the pyroclastic flow side of things, not the lava flow.
So you're exactly, your expertise is where Dante's Peak got it exactly wrong.
No, they got it. Well, the pyroclastic flow was great.
Oh,
I love that scene.
So now just...
Wait. So they were able to include pyroclastic flow with lava, but the lava part was false.
The lava part's completely wrong.
For that particular volcano.
Yes.
So briefly, tell us about pyroclastic flow.
So yeah, pyroclastic flow is basically...
Chuck knows it, but for the rest of us...
I'm going to go get some coffee now, Janine, because, you know, pyroclastic flow, I mean, that's where I'm a Viking.
what do you think it is?
She's calling you out.
Yeah, exactly.
Chuck just left for coffee. Yeah. So tell us about it.
It's this really fast, really hot cloud of hot gas and hot volcanic rock. So it's basically a racing cloud of death that goes down a volcano and can destroy everything in its path. So they showed that very, very well in the movie. In fact, that was the scene where I watched it as a 13-year-old girl going, that's what I'm going to study for the rest of my life.
Whoa. Wow. Talk about inspiration. That is cool.
So wait. Just to clarify, listen to what she just said. She said, I saw this rolling cloud of hot death, and I want to study that for the rest of my life.
That's what 16-year-old girls do, right?
Exactly.
Very cool. So how would you generally rate the science in Dante's Peak? Is it one of the best volcano movies? Because, you know, the Pompeii has been done 5 or 6 times, mm-hmm. you know, since movies could be made. Where would you rank that?
I'd rank it at the top. By a very big margin.
Oh, wow. Okay. High praise from Caesar.
What would you say they did best? And what would you say they did worst?
The best, I'm a bit biased, but the pyroclastic flow was fantastic.
You think she's
biased? The ash plume was great. The ash spreading out over the town was fantastic. The uncertainty around the eruption as it's leading towards eruption is pretty good. The monitoring that they're using, the different tools like seismicity, measuring the gas is fantastic. Not so great was the volcanic ash. I have a major beef with the volcanic ash. And of course, the lava flow, that's the volcanic elephant in the room. Mm-hmm. And they did the Lahar really great too, that mud flow that wiped out the bridge and killed our fearless leader, unfortunately. And with the outrunning of the pyroclastic flow, so they make it into the mine shaft. It looks like everything's okay. Really, that really hot, scorching gas cloud probably would have got them a bit there in the end.
Right. And so what was the problem with the ash? You said I had a real problem with the volcanic ash. Why?
They have used wet newspaper, so it looks fluffy and really soft. But in reality, volcanic ash is pulverized rock, crystals, and glass.
Ooh.
So it's really nasty stuff. It can collapse roofs. It can cause breathing issues. You do not want it in your eyes. It's horrible.
Oh. So ash is just the wrong word.
It's a wrong word. Yeah. It's not ash.
It's not ash.
Yeah. It's volcanic glass.
Volcanic pins and needles.
Yeah, exactly. Volcanic shards.
Shards.
That's what it is. Here. It's volcanic shards.
Volcanic doomy bits.
Yeah.
So how about the banter among the science folk in the movie? Because that takes research to get that right. How did they do there?
I think they did pretty good, especially the coffee addiction. That's a really important part of being a scientist, probably in many fields. The gung-ho nature of Dr. Harry Dalton is a bit too much. We would always want more data. We wouldn't want to go straight and scare the crap out of the townspeople. That's not what we do.
Until you have enough data to do so.
Right.
Exactly.
Yeah,
exactly.
But don't try to play like you don't want to scare the crap out of the townspeople.
That part's pretty good.
Well, you hear what Chuck said? Chuck, repeat
yeah,
that.
Yeah, I said, don't play like you don't want to scare the crap out of the townspeople, because you know that's one of the parts of your job you enjoy most.
I haven't got to do it yet, so I'm not sure. I have to come back to you on that one.
Okay.
just to repeat, you are certifying Dante's Peak, with all of its shortcomings, as being the finest scientific, the most representatively accurate volcano movie ever made, head and shoulders above all others.
Including Joe and the Volcano.
Joe and the Volcano?
As a doctor in volcanology, yes. Yes, I do.
Cool.
And could the fact that New Zealand has had some unfortunate encounters with earthquakes in recent decades, Christchurch being almost completely destroyed, has that had an influence on your curiosity about the raging earth?
I was actually on my way long before that. I look a lot younger than I really am.
Okay.
If you say so yourself.
But, no, living in New Zealand, I grew up around volcanoes. So I always loved volcanoes since before I could remember. So, yeah, the landscape I grew up in has definitely made an impact.
Cool. Can I ask a question just unrelated to sci-fi? This is actually very, very real. There are some people who advocate for the denial of climate chaos and being caused by humans that say that volcanoes are kind of the culprit here, that they dump more
CO2
yes. into the atmosphere than anything else could ever do so, and that we're wasting our time trying to mitigate human activity with respect to producing carbon. What do you say to those people?
I can see why people think that. In fact, people don't even realize just how much activity there is when they think that. But in reality, volcanoes on land and underwater produce less than 1% of carbon dioxide than people do. So it's
boom.
So true it's just not.
So let me bring this to a close and ask you, is there some volcano movie that you can imagine wanting to consult on that takes it in another direction, or it's uncharted territory for the science fiction media?
Ah, goodness, that's a good question. We've done the super volcano thing. That's been overkilled.
How about underwater volcanoes or ice volcanoes, ooh, as we have on some of the moons of Jupiter?
Oh,
that'd
yeah.
be a neat one to do. Yeah. Would we be in space, or has this somehow happening on Earth now?
Yeah, astronauts on a planet that has ice volcanoes. How about that?
That's a good. Actually, I will see that movie.
Because
that's a good movie, dude.
Because you know, we think of volcanoes as a place where hot things come out of,
right?
But it's only a place where there's high pressure. And you can have high pressure on a place that's very cold.
Right.
Where something boils at 100 degrees below zero.
Right.
All right. And so now everything is icy to us, but you have high pressure volcanic circumstances on these other places. Okay. So if we get that to happen, we'll make sure you're on the list for their consultants.
Yeah.
I would absolutely consult. There need to be more scientists consulted on movies, as I'm sure you will agree.
Well, excellent. So thanks for coming on, bringing your expertise to us.
My pleasure.
Excellent. Okay. Thank you.
That was a very cool. She was very cool.
Yes. Yes.
I like the idea of the ice volcanoes too. Mm-hmm. That's right. But Jason, do you have any volcanic sci-fi literature that you dig?
Not in literature.
Dig? What is it? The 1967? What?
Yeah.
Can you dig it?
That's right, man. I'm a mad cat.
I dig it.
I'm digging it, babe.
I say the same thing to my students. They probably don't know what I'm talking about.
Right. I don't know why I just turned into Sammy Davis Jr.
No. You didn't turn into Sammy Davis. You turned into Austin Powers there.
Yeah, like, baby. Oh, V, hey.
Okay.
Okay, go ahead.
So what volcanoes do you dig?
Well, I can't think of any in literature that I've read about, but I'm thinking in terms of the movie that you just pitched to the volcanologist that we spoke with, Europa Report. It seemed like part of the story centers on like how unstable the surfaces where they land on Europa. which those you could either see or maybe turn different ways to be like ice volcanoes, and the inherent danger of studying an environment like that.
Cool. That is very cool.
Do you know how I know about the Europa Report?
No.
Because I'm in it.
Are you really?
Yes.
Get out.
Yeah, no, this is my office. I ain't getting out. You get out.
What are you doing there?
It was a cheap shot. So at first, it's a nicely done lower budget sci-fi film.
Okay.
And it's called the Europa Report. They try to take a different angle on how you might make a movie.
Right.
So this is a mission to Europa to see if there's life there.
Right.
And the entire movie are just the cameras stitched together from the different cameras in the ship and outside the ship.
Oh.
So throughout the entire movie, it's like, camera 3, camera 6. Someone walks over there, camera 8. And so it is the report of this mission assembled by basically the video cameras positioned around the ship. So that's the premise for it.
Okay.
And they used a clip of me being interviewed by the news saying, I want to go to Europa because it has an icy surface and an ocean below, and I want to cut a hole and go ice fishing on Europa, see if anything swims up to the camera lens. So they used that clip
of me.
They
used that clip. That's cool.
They paid me, too.
Get out.
That totally me. I forgot I was just like $1,000. I said, yeah, good.
It's found money.
Yeah, there it is. Let me think. Okay, do it.
Right.
So it was an interesting attempt. And you're right. The surface is very unstable because it's ice sheets floating on water that is being heated. And there are heat sources. And so when you heat water under ice, the ice is not stable. It breaks. It refreezes.
Right.
And you can have a ice phenomenon that you might not otherwise be familiar with.
That's cool, man.
Right.
Yeah, I think I read where that they see the fissures change.
Yes.
On Europa.
Yes.
And
yes.
That's how they know that this ice is melting and refreezing and melting and refreezing.
And if you find life on Europa, you know what we'll call it?
No.
Europeans.
Oh, no.
we gotta take a break.
Oh, God. Help us. Help us, Europe.
We're going to take our next break. When we come back, more on Star Talk. We're talking about sci-fi in movies, TV, and literature when we return.
If you travel, you know how to really go off the grid. Like no cell service in your room off the grid. You know which remote retreats have the best herbal baths, sound baths, and ice baths. Because when you set up your out of office, you mean it. Because when you're the escape artist, vacation is all about resting, meditating, drinking water, and minding your own businessing. The Delta SkyMiles Platinum American Express card. If you travel, you know. Learn more at go.amex/you know.
Do you want to set up your child for success? Of course you do. Maybe you want to save money on private tutoring, or maybe it's just out of your budget altogether. Is this a big school year for your child? Like maybe they're starting kindergarten, middle school, or high school, or some other milestone. Maybe your family moved and they're starting at a new school. Is your child ahead? Not getting challenged enough in class? Well, we love that little smarty, but we want them to be engaged. IXL Learning is an online learning program for kids covering math, language arts, science, and social studies. IXL is designed to help them really understand and master topics in a fun way. Powered by advanced algorithms, IXL gives the right help to each kid, no matter the age or the personality. There's one site for all the kids in your home, pre-K to 12th grade. Kids can use it at home on the computer or on the go through the app on your phone or your tablet. No more grading those worksheets. IXL grades everything itself. And no more trying to figure out how to explain math equations or grammar rules yourself. IXL has built-in explanation videos. 1 in 4 students in the U.S. are learning with IXL. IXL is used in 95 of the top 100 school districts in the U.S. Make an impact on your child's learning. Get IXL now. And Star Talk Radio listeners can get an exclusive 20% off IXL membership when they sign up today at IXL.com/StarTalk. Visit IXL.com/StarTalk to get the most effective learning program out there at the best price.
This is a big year. The Ohio Lottery's golden anniversary. 50 years of excitement, of growing jackpots and crossed fingers. 50 years of funding for schools, of changed lives and brightened days. 50 years of fun. And that is worth celebrating. So watch for can't-miss promotions, huge events, and new games that will make the Ohio Lottery's 50th year its biggest one yet. Learn more at funturns50.com.
Bringing space and science down to Earth. You're listening to Star Talk.
We're back, Star Talk. Neil deGrasse Tyson here, your personal astrophysicist. By the way, we are recording this in my office at the Hayden Planetarium of the American Museum of Natural History. Right here in New York City.
Better known as the Cosmic Crib.
The Cosmic Crib. We haven't done some Cosmic Crib lately. Come back to Cosmic Crib and do some episodes. We got Chuck Nice, of course.
That's right.
Jason, professor. A professor of sci-fi. You know, that should not be allowed. That's too fun.
Yeah, that is a pretty cool title. You know what I mean?
How many kids take your class? Is it one of the more popular classes?
It's one of the more popular classes, yeah.
Look how he's so casual. Yeah, it just happens to be the most popular in all of campus.
I've taught at Georgia Tech as well as here at City Tech, and students always want to sign up for it.
Very, very cool. Well, we're featuring my interview with Gail Ann Hurd, one of these highly prolific producers of really innovative science fiction material from the Terminator trilogy right on up through The Walking Dead. On television, which went through how many seasons was that up to?
Clearly, she's not. It's a shame she hasn't come into her own.
She's got to figure out She's still figuring things out.
She'll get there.
So I had to ask her, what was it like to work in two completely different media? Television, where there are multiple stories or you can develop more subtleties within a story over many episodes, and a movie, we got to go and get the job done and get out. So I have to understand.
Excellent.
How does that work? Let's check it out.
What I've discovered, having been both a feature film producer and a television producer, is that with a feature, you spend 2, maybe 3 years making a 2.5-hour film.
It's a one-shot deal. Yeah.
And so you've got to get all that character in, you've got to get all that plot in, you've got to wrap it all up. And with a series like Falling Water, we have 10 hours to do that.
So those 10 installments?
Yes, there are 10 episodes.
So it's a 10-hour movie?
It's essentially, yes. So we get to learn so much more about the characters, dive so much more deeply, not only into that, but into the mythology, into the world.
And into the conceit of the storytelling.
Yes, and the stakes are so much greater because you can unfold them and, you know, unspool it more slowly and get more and more invested.
Because when you do a movie and you have to get all of that out in the hour and a half or 2 hours, it looks very forced.
Exactly.
To completely open up a character.
And that's one of the constraints of the medium. And television is much different. You know, you can, once you're connected, you know there's going to be so much more. I mean, let's say a film like Inception, there's not a sequel. So if you really wanted to follow these characters into the future, that's not happening. Or if it does, it'll happen, you know, 5, 10 years later.
So tell me, Jason, tell me about the difference between developing a cool science tech storyline and developing the characters within the story. Because it's clear that a movie has a harder time developing people than a 10-hour movie or a 10-hour TV series would. So how, as a consumer of this medium and a teacher of it, how do you split that?
Well, whenever you're thinking about like television, you have a lot more time to develop not only the characters, but do the world building necessary for the audience to really engage in the ideas of the show, like with Star Trek, for example.
World building, I like that.
I like that.
That's good, yeah.
But whereas like a film, you have to jump right in and get straight to the point. Otherwise, you could either lose the audience or it could slow the pace of the film down so much that the audience begins dozing off. Also, another issue that relates both to series and film has to do with novels, that when you write a novel or short story, you can provide interiority, you can provide the thoughts of the characters, which you can't really do on film or in television other than like
in
flashbacks.
In awkward ways.
In awkward ways, yeah. Exactly.
Yeah. Right. Except Japanese anime, where they're always doing that. That's all they do, is give you the interiority of what the character is. It's always what the character's thinking at all times.
Is that a word,
know?
Interiority?
I don't know.
That's new to me.
It is, yeah.
I just heard him say it.
Yeah. And you picked it up like that?
Yeah.
You act like you knew that word your whole life.
Hell no. No, I knew it for 30 seconds, and that is all I need.
So that's interesting how clumsy it can be to get inside someone's head without having them be a whispered narration over their thoughts.
So what's a mechanism as a writer that you can use to portray like the thought patterns of a character without doing that, you know, that they're showing the close-up of the face and it's just like...
And they look off it.
Right, and they're looking off and it's just like, I don't think I can do this. I'm not sure if I can make this happen. Like, you know, what can you do?
And really good actors can convey those emotions just by their facial expressions.
Oh, my God, you're absolutely right. Yeah, like Meryl Streep, I think that's one of her strongest points.
So back to your expertise here. So tell us.
But you're exactly right. The things about like nonverbal information from facial expressions, the way a person carries themselves, the tonality of their voice, but also film techniques like the cinematography, the way the shot is framed, the color scale that's used for background or foreground.
I bet music can carry
and
some
obviously
too.
Music is the biggest
which you don't
thing.
Have in a book.
Right.
And this is the thing, is not to say that one medium is superior to another. Each of them have different affordances, things that they can do, and constraints, things that they can't do in order to tell a story. And I think a masterful storyteller uses the medium's affordances to their maximum capability to be able to tell the story, but also involve the audience in those emotions and those characters.
I have affordances too, by the way. I just learned two words today. How's your affordance?
Yeah, exactly.
So nowadays, with streaming services, where they'll drop an entire series all at once, do you think the future of sci-fi is bright because now sci-fi can have the same kind of treatment as other long dramatic stories that have been dragged out for multiple episodes have done in the past?
I think so. Like maybe a good example would be The Expanse.
Yes! Oh my God, I was just about to say that. So I'm sorry.
I didn't give you that affordance.
I know. I get very excited, but that is a trim. If you, people listening, if you get the chance, watch The Expanse. I found it by mistake, and 4 days later, I was sitting there unshaven and smelly. I was like, this is so good.
There's no higher compliment in modern times.
Exactly. You know, but they do the science well.
Who's streaming this?
I think it's Amazon, if I'm not mistaken. So. But they do the science well, and it was cool because, you know, I sit at the feet of the master all the time here, and I get to hear and learn a lot about what really happens in space. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that they do very well is let you see that in zero gravity, you are a helpless little baby.
Yours is one of the most helpless states you could ever be in.
There is nothing you can do. And they do it really well. But anyway, I'm sorry. I got excited. I interrupted you. Go ahead, The Expanse.
But you make a really good point about like you stumbled onto it by mistake, right?
Right.
And I think that with streaming services and this new way that we're consuming media actually may introduce science fiction to more people now because they just stumble onto things or try something out in a way that was harder to do in the past where you had to tune into the channel at a certain day, a certain time.
Yeah.
And if you didn't, well, then you totally missed it. But now with things being shared on social media, recommendations, or things that you find just browsing through Netflix or Amazon.
And no one's going to jump in the middle if they can start at the beginning.
Exactly.
So you got them.
And the cool thing about The Expanse is they take... the geopolitical relationships between countries that we have right now, and they expand that to become intersolar relationships between people who are born in the asteroid belt, in the Kuiper belt, people who are born on Mars at 38% gravity, and Earthers who are, and so over this long period of time, human beings have kind of, you know, not really evolved.
So if they're born on Earth, are they birthers? That was good. Chuck, that was good.
I'm going to give it to you only because I'm a birther. But, yeah, and it's really, it's very funny because the prejudices that we hold towards one another here on Earth now just becomes different prejudices that we hold towards each other based on where, which planet or which region of the solar system that you're born in.
So, Jason, let me ask you, are there untapped, possibly low-hanging fruit available for the sci-fi author now that we have these media, these new ways of delivering storytelling?
I think so. And, you know, Netflix has jumped at this, like with the streaming of the series Black Mirror, I think.
Right.
But no, they take, you know, things that we're all very familiar with and just push it a little bit into the future, near future science fiction.
Yeah. So that it's, you can almost touch it.
Right.
But not quite.
Right.
Just almost touch it enough to scare the bejesus out of you.
Right.
Right.
Yeah.
But it's through the, you know, this platform of being able to stream you know, a series of movies or just watching one individual episode, I think immerses people in these ideas and gets them thinking about them in a way that science fiction is given to, as opposed to other media where it's more just about a dramatic story.
So there's another aspect to this storytelling that I think I briefly discussed with Gail Ann Hurd, and it has to do with not only are you imagining the science, but how much of the science are you getting right and what value that might have to your audience? Let's check it out. So now, I think, and I'd like to get your verification of this, or falsification, I think we live in a time where if you get the science right, there is an entire other following that the movie will pick up in the blogosphere, where people compliment the science that it gets right, and it gets talked about for months beyond the normal marketing period.
Like the Martian?
Like the Martian. Like the Martian. And so I'd like to believe that gone are the days we just make stuff up because you think it looks better, and then you alienate an entire community of people who could have praised you for doing it accurately. And the more we are in this era that I'm thinking we're entering, the more pressure there is on producers, directors, to bring in a scientist, and maybe...
By the way, we had scientists on each of those films.
I don't believe you had a single scientist on Armageddon.
We've had multiple scientists
you're
on
lying.
Armageddon.
No, no.
including futurists from NASA. In fact, we even shot in the neutral buoyancy tank.
In Houston?
Yes.
Yes, that's it. In fact, there was a whole scale model of the Hubble telescope submerged there so that the astronauts who would be servicing it, you know, it's kind of, it's not perfect zero-G, but you get that floaty feel to it. And so, yeah, that's good. Good. But I'm saying...
Well, I am not arguing with you. I am not arguing with... The at least we knew that we were breaking those laws.
So, Jason, how do you feel when you see bad science in a film?
I don't think it's necessarily always a bad thing, but I would say that it's unfortunate today because obviously audiences are more well-educated, and I think there is a certain expectation that the science is right.
Do you agree with me about the blogosphere? There's a whole geek community that cares about real science.
Oh, I think that you're absolutely right about that. But I can also say as a warning, like when Sunshine by Danny Boyle was released, I saw it in a theater in Liverpool, England. And after the film was over, I was complaining to all my friends quite vocally about how bad the science was in parts of it, especially about like restarting the sun. And unbeknownst to me...
Sorry, I didn't see the movie, but they restart... That kind of, sounds kind of cool, though. Mm.
It is kind of cool, except that it's a very small like nuclear package that they use to kickstart things.
To kickstart the sun.
The sun. Yeah, okay. I mean,
matters of scale here.
That'll go.
We get a Bic lighter up there.
wait, my my pilot light went out. Yeah, go on.
But what unbeknownst to me was that Danny Boyle's family was sitting in the row behind me. And they kind of leaned over and gave me some dirty looks. It made me a little uncomfortable. And I thought about it, and it's obviously a tremendous success for someone to be able to make a film, right? To realize
yes,
their
all.
Artistic...
At all.
At all, right? But I do think that if you were going to be putting these millions of dollars toward making a film, why not make it a film that has more real science, that can teach people as well as entertain them?
True. Yeah. I mean, sometimes it's like, what's the movie where... They basically play around with the tenets of string theory and Matthew McConaughey.
Interstellar.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. Yeah, yes.
Okay.
And so I loved all the questions that they posed mm-hmm. in the movie, but then it comes down to love.
So I never thought about it till this moment. Maybe Interstellar spent too much time on getting their science right and not enough time on the emotion and the interpersonal stories
right.
that mm-hmm. would be embedded within it.
Yeah, there's a balance. Yeah, there's got to be a balance.
There's got to be. Otherwise, yeah. So you can praise it for its science, but then if there's no story, or if the story is not otherwise convincing novelistically, mm-hmm. then what do you have at the end of the day? Because I think we're all fundamentally storytellers, story listeners, even as adults.
That's yeah, what we are. Absolutely. Yeah, I think it's core to being a human being is really stories, you know?
Well, related to this is Hugo Gernsback, the father of science fiction, started the first science fiction magazine in April 1926, Amazing Stories. And he defined science fiction in part as being 75% romance and 25% science.
I didn't know that.
Nice.
That's early.
Wow. And so even from that beginning point of what we think of as modern science fiction, there was this idea that you have to have a balance between being able to tell a story that is about people while bringing in to show how science and technology influences and affect people and how people respond to those challenges.
Mm. Nice. Yeah. Excellent. I'm going to go home and write a story right now.
The way I think of this is, yeah, you should try to get the science right, but don't let that stop your creativity. But often there's newly discovered science in any branch of science that might be more creative on its frontier than you can be trying to make stuff up.
Ooh.
So why not reach for that edge? My field, that edge overflows. We gave you wormholes, black holes, the vacuum of space, antimatter, mm-hmm. that's photons, lasers. We gave you that.
Jason, do you see him bragging?
Yeah, I don't mean to brag, but because I can tell you, there's a famous quote from J.B.S. Haldane, and it's, the universe is not only stranger than we have imagined, it may be stranger than we can imagine.
Ooh.
Which to me says that there's no greater source of material to mine mm-hmm. for science fiction storytelling than the science itself. Just make sure you get that three quarters romance. All right. And that is A Cosmic Perspective. You've been listening to, possibly even watching, this episode of Star Talk. I want to thank you, Jason. Thank mm-hmm. you, Chuck.
Yes.
For this episode.
Thank you, guys. Thank this you. Was great.
Okay. And until next time, as always, I bid you to keep looking up.
This is a big year. The Ohio Lottery's golden anniversary. 50 years of excitement, of growing jackpots and crossed fingers. 50 years of funding for schools, of changed lives and brightened days. 50 years of fun, and that is worth celebrating. So watch for can't-miss promotions, huge events, and new games that will make the Ohio Lottery's 50th year its biggest one yet. Learn more at funturns50.com.
Time for a quick break to talk about McDonald's. Mornings are for mixing and matching at McDonald's. For just $3, mix and match two of your favorite breakfast items, including a sausage McMuffin, sausage biscuit, sausage burrito, and hash browns. Make it even better with a delicious medium iced coffee. With McDonald's mix and match, you can't go wrong. Price and participation may vary. Cannot be combined with any other offer or combo meal. Single item at regular price.